Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. We have got a topic that is always controversial. It's wonderful sometimes to bring it up in mixed company because people go, well, I don't know if I believe in this or not. Or somebody else goes, squeaky says, oh, I really think it's real. Then you're off and running with a conversation that's full of contradictions and sometimes some absolutely amazing facts. And my guest today is Nick Redfern. We're going to be talking about contactees, a history of alien human interaction. Does it sound a little bit like sci-fi? You haven't heard anything yet. My guest, Nick Redfern, is with us. Nick, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me on the show.
I want my audience to know that you write a great deal, and you also come in your writings from a position of being a journalist. You really like dealing with the unique, the unusual, unsolved mysteries, and of course that's going to bring us right into a hot topic of ETs or contactees, alien, you know, whatever goes. You've written for a number of magazines, Fate, UFO Magazine, Paranormal Magazine, you've got other books that you've put out, but you really were telling me some interesting information, and it was about your dad and how you got interested in those stories and events involving visitors from other planets. So tell us how that all happened for you.
Well, my father worked in the British Royal Air Force, the equivalent of the US Air Force, and his speciality was in the field of radar. And he worked on radar with the Royal Air Force in the 1950s and was involved in several incidents where very fast-moving unknown objects, unidentified objects, were tracked on the radar scopes approaching the east coast of the British Isles from the region of Scandinavia, in other words, Norway, Sweden, Denmark. And even though these objects were traveling at incredible speeds and performing fantastic maneuvers, the first thought was, well, this has to be some sort of sneak attack by the Russians, bearing in mind it was the height of the Cold War.
Right.
And so aircraft were sent up from a nearby Air Force base to try and intercept these objects. And the pilots reportedly couldn't get close to these objects, whatever they were, and eventually were forced to return back to base because they were running low on fuel. And this went on over the course of several nights. And when the incidents finally came to a close, everybody who was involved in the affair, from the radar people, the pilots, the ground crews, etc., everybody was told that they'd signed the British government's and British military's Official Secrets Act, and you won't talk about this with your family, friends, and certainly not with the media. And my dad didn't tell anybody, really, pretty much till I was about 14 years of age, and you know, this was like the turn of the 1980s, and he related this story to me, and I suppose in many respects it got me interested for two reasons. One, because you know it was coming from my own dad, who you know I trusted, but also it was coming from someone who served in the military and was trained as an expert in the field of radar. So, you know, someone who's clearly knew what they were talking about when it comes to tracking and interpreting objects on the radar scopes. And I suppose that sort of really set me on the path of looking into the UFO mystery and trying to determine what was at the heart of it. So I suppose I've got my dad to blame for this sort of weird and wonderful road I've been on for the last 20 years or so.
Well, what an adventure, because in your research, you have come through with so many points of information. And one of the things I like about your presentation, and I mentioned this to you before we went on the air, is that I like how you come from what I consider, and this is my interpretation, that view of a skeptic. In other words, it's here, I'm telling you these things because this is what I've checked out. So I like that kind of a presentation, because you're not just saying, swallow this hook, line, and sinker, I question this, I question that. And I think this is healthy. I think questioning is a very, very good thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want people to think that I'm a skeptic, period, Donna. I mean, I do believe there's a genuine UFO mystery, and I do believe we are being visited by entities from, you know, wherever. But what I've always felt with any aspect of the unexplained is that it's important not to just accept every story, you know, at first glance and face value, that it's important that from a journalistic perspective that we look into the intricacies of each account. And for the most part, you know, I think a lot of cases have a great deal of merit to them. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we find ones that aren't so good, others that maybe somebody was hoaxing, etc. But, you know, that still doesn't take away the fact that when we get rid of the cases that aren't so good, we're still left with a very good body of evidence suggesting a very real UFO phenomenon amongst us. So, you know, I'm certainly not a debunker or an outright skeptic. I'm just someone who knows something weird's going on, but, you know, just kind of tries to look at all the cases at a singular level and see where each of them takes us.
And that is what makes your book such an interesting read,
the way you
present the information. Now, of course, the introduction to your book, I'm going to start off with that right away, because I'm in the Pacific Northwest, and Mount Rainier I can see almost from my backyard. And you have, right off the bat, the statement that the era of the flying saucer was ushered in on June 24th, 1947, because of a pilot named Kenneth Arnold. And, of course, I have met a number of people up here that have seen activity about Mount Rainier. You mentioned a man, Wayne Aho, and I met Wayne Aho many years ago. And this man, his experiences on a personal level were just, I mean, he just, it's like this was such a passion for him, because he said, we've got to pay attention to these things, because he had experiences in the military. And when I found his name in your book, I thought, this is really interesting. Talk about Kenneth Arnold for those of my listeners that may not know about him.
Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons why, Donna, I feel there's a lot of genuine UFO reports out there, because like Kenneth Arnold, many of the encounters reported by experienced pilots. And Kenneth Arnold was flying over the Cascade Mountains on June 24th, 1947. He was actually looking for an aircraft that had crashed somewhere in the mountains, and it was sort of like an emergency rescue mission to try and find it. And he unfortunately didn't find the aircraft, but he said that as he was flying over Mount Rainier, he saw out of his window almost described as like a formation of unknown objects, and one of them was glinting in the sun, which caught his eye. And what really sort of stood out for Kenneth Arnold was the fact that when he was looking at the objects, he couldn't see any wings or tail or fuselage that you would associate with a normal conventional aircraft. And as he closed in on them, he said that they were, I guess, like elliptical shaped, almost like a swept back wing, almost like the stealth bomber or the stealth fighter that we have today. But he said that when he later spoke to a journalist when he landed, he said that they flew like a saucer might fly if you skipped it across a body of water, kind of like a, you know, if you throw a stone on a body of water, it kind of bounces and moves up and down slightly. And of course, you know, this stuck, the idea of a flying saucer. And so it was Kenneth Arnold, really, who ushered in the modern-day era of UFOs. And certainly in the wake of Kenneth Arnold's sighting all across the United States in the weeks and months that followed, there were countless UFO reports. And certainly the famous incident at Roswell actually only occurred just over a week after Kenneth Arnold's encounter. So you had, his was 24th of June. And Roswell was either the 2nd or the 3rd of July, depending on, you know, when we're not entirely sure. So in other words, two of the most famous aspects of the UFO mystery were both ushered in within a week of each other.
One of the people that you have in here is George Adaminsky, and you said that this was the ultimate contactee. He was born in the late 1800s, 1891.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you consider him the ultimate contactee?
Well, more than anything else, he was a man who, I suppose, defined what it meant, what it means to be a contactee to this day, because we still get reports even now. But his story basically began in the 1930s. He was originally from Poland. When he was a young boy, his family moved to the United States, and he settled in California. And he set up an organization, very much like a spiritual organization called the Royal Order of Tibet, which I guess kind of promoted an alternative sort of spiritual lifestyle, which, you know, today wouldn't raise any eyebrows and shouldn't raise any eyebrows, but back then it was,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the 30s it was seen as slightly unusual. So in other words, he was someone who was perhaps primed to have an encounter with UFOs or of an unknown kind, because he was very open to, you know, living a lifestyle that taught spiritual issues, you know, that's kind of profoundly elevating mind, body, and spirit, etc. And he said that in 1952, for reasons that he was never really too sure of, he felt compelled and driven to take a journey out to one particular part of the California desert, where he said, along with a group of friends, this classic flying saucer-type object came out of the sky, landed, and this very human-looking alien came out of the craft. And he actually described the being as almost looking angelic-like. It was very human-like, had a head of long blonde hair, and seemed to radiate a slight, like an iridescent glow.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that there was a telepathic exchange between the two of them, where the alien entity spoke about or gave warnings concerning the development of atomic weaponry on the Earth, and how the human race, if it didn't change its ways, would be heading for extinction. And Adamski basically kind of followed up on the words and advice of this particular being after the craft left, and really felt that he was on some sort of, almost like a spiritual mission,
mm-hmm.
to spread the word of what the alien being had told him. And he actually went on to write a number of well-received and best-selling books on the subject. His first one, co-written with an Irishman named Desmond Leslie, which was called Flying Saucers Have Landed. In its first U.S. printing alone, it sold in excess of 125,000 copies.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, you know, bear in mind this was now 57 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the man had developed this huge following, and that's why in many respects, you know, I consider him the ultimate contactee. He was one of the first and one of the most famous contactees, but also someone who went out and successfully informed the public of what he was told, and in return developed this huge following as well.
Well, didn't the FBI also get involved with him because they thought he was something of a nutcase? But yet
they didn't.
They were following up on him. They were involved with
a lot of the contactees.
Yeah, really, yeah. I mean, this is something where that really caused a lot mm-hmm. of concern. And I remember Wayne Aho.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you've mentioned him slightly in your book, and I remember that he often had interactions with people that either from the FBI and sometimes from the CIA, and so, you know, they may publicly deny a lot of this, but yet so many people that were explorers of this or had personal experiences of their own, they were checked on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what I did, Donna, I used the Freedom of Information Act to apply for files on the contactees. And I was quite surprised that, you know, initially I thought, well, I'm just going to get a denial that any files exist. But the FBI were quite open and said, yes, we have files on George Adamski and four or five other of the contactees. And, for example, one of the equally famous contactees of George Adamski was a man named George Van Tassel, who also claimed UFO encounters in the California desert. And his FBI file runs to 398 pages and covers a period of 15 years. And that's kind of similar with George Adamski as well. So in other words, the FBI was watching these people very closely, and in many respects were, I suppose, trying to not so much debunk them, but were trying to demystify their importance. And reading between the lines of the files, I get the feeling and the opinion that the FBI of the 1950s was deeply concerned and worried by the message of the so-called Space Brothers, as they became known, and the conduits, the contactees. They were concerned that people would pick up on these stories, would be influenced by the contactees, and would potentially, you know, go out and, again, follow a lifestyle according to the Space Brothers, you know, to the alien visitors. And I think the FBI, and as is often the case with governments, you know, they want people's allegiance to be to the government. They don't want it to be to visitors from some other world who may be trying to offer us, you know, a better or alternative way of life. And I think that was one of the reasons for the FBI taking such an intense notice of these people. They were worried that the influence that it would have on the populace if it became clear that aliens really were walking and moving amongst us.
George Van Tassel, who was born in Ohio, an American, 1910, this man, you titled this chapter, Rocking with Giants, and the FBI, again, was really checking this guy out, but one of the things that happened because of his interaction with that he came in contact with was a concern, they said, with the nuclear detonations that were going on. It was really going to have an impact on the Earth, and I can remember years ago talking to someone about that and saying that energy has to go somewhere. And when I came across that information in your book, and I'll quote from it, explosions of these bombs have upset the Earth's rotation, and as in the instance of the French bomb explosion in North Africa, have actually caused earthquakes, and explosions are forcing the Earth towards another polar tilt, which will endanger all mankind. Now, this was information that was given to him, and because he was vocal, tell us a little bit about George Van Tassel.
Yeah, very much like George Agansky, he moved to California to live. He actually had an interesting background. He was a skilled aviation worker and was actually good friends and worked with Howard Hughes at the Hughes Aircraft Company, then moved to California and ran a small airstrip out in the California desert near a small town called Landers. And it was while living outside of Landers that Van Tassel said he had a number of experiences with extraterrestrials, most of which were physical face-to-face encounters, one of which, he said, was almost like what we would call an out-of-body experience, like an astral encounter, if you like. But the message was very similar to that of George Adamski and his aliens, in the sense that it was talking about the perils of nuclear war and the future of the planet if we didn't kind of mend our ways. And in the same way that Adamski went out and wrote books about his experiences, George Van Tassel felt compelled to put on a yearly conference out at a place called Giant Rock, which is just outside of the town of Landers. And the area is called Giant Rock because there is this literally huge rock out in the middle of the desert. And he held the conferences there every year. And at their height, they were getting audiences in the region of about 12,000. Which is, you know, a huge number of people to have attending a UFO conference. Never mind today, you know, never mind back then. And again, you know, as you pointed out, you know, he was given this message about how nuclear weaponry was, we're sort of dicing with the future of the planet and the human race by dabbling in nuclear weaponry. And that, again, was one of the major, I suppose, selling points of Van Tassel's lectures and his several books that he wrote, how, you know, the aliens had come to visit us at a time when we were on the verge of developing space flight. We'd already made tentative steps with atomic weaponry, and they felt that this was the time when, if we were going to destroy ourselves, we might well be on the verge of it, and they wanted to come and try and subtly push us in the right direction, but not overwhelm us by landing and, you know, integrating themselves into our society and us being absorbed into their society, if you like. It was almost an attempt to keep our society as it was, but give us a few subtle hints and pointers, etc. And again, he had a very extensive FBI file where the FBI would clandestinely go out and sit in the audiences at his lectures and conferences and things like that. And basically, you know, report back to J. Edgar Hoover as to what was being said. And in other words, you know, again, as with George Adamski, it points out and demonstrates how concerned the FBI gets or got when someone talks about something like this and galvanizes a huge number of people behind them to support them. And I think, you know, again, the FBI was showing concern with Van Tassel that this man isn't just talking about UFOs, but he's showing people how, you know, they can live a lifestyle according to these aliens that isn't necessarily what the FBI wanted. And so they actually, you know, as I said, watched him very closely for somewhere in the region of 13 or 14 years.
You have a chapter on alternative aliens, and I'm going to quote from the first page of that chapter about some tales are beyond ludicrous, but when those same tales involve a senior figure within the British military and agents of the CIA, perhaps we should not be so quick to dismiss them. And this I found fascinating. You had particular individuals, George King, that you mentioned here. You also have Air Marshal Sir Bresford Peter Torrington Horsley, who was with the British military, and then a person called Mr. Janus. Give my audience a little bit of the flavor of that chapter. It's intriguing, to say the least.
Yeah, that's a very strange story, Donna. Sir Peter Horsley was a very senior figure within the British military and also worked very closely with the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, and her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh. And at the height of his career with the military, the British military, it wouldn't be far off incorrect to say for American listeners that he was probably about the closest thing you can think of in the 60s and 70s in England to somebody in the US like Colin Powell. You know, he held that sort of position of responsibility. And in the event of a nuclear war, he was one of the few people whose finger would have been on that red button, you know, if we had to launch the missiles back at Russia or whoever. So in other words, he wasn't just like a lowly figure within the government or the military. He was a highly influential, learned, scholarly person. And this obviously only makes his story all the more intriguing. He said that in the early 1950s, he was introduced under sort of clandestine circumstances by several people in the military. He was introduced to a man who identified himself by the name of Mr. Janus. And according to Mr. Janus, he was essentially a very human-looking extraterrestrial who, again, was visiting the Earth covertly, and because he looked very human-looking, had the ability to move amongst us pretty much unnoticed, and again, exhibiting concerns about the way in which we were sort of recklessly developing atomic weaponry and building up nuclear arsenals. And Sir Peter Horsley said that he met this Mr. Janus in an apartment in London where they had a deep conversation all about matters of a cosmic nature and universal nature. And he even said that he felt that this Mr. Janus was able to read his mind and preempt his thoughts before Sir Peter asked certain questions of him. Now, of course, you know, this sounds highly controversial, but as I said, When we place it in the context of this of someone akin to, you know, Colin Powell or the, you know, a high-ranking figure within the Pentagon, then it puts it in a whole different light. Now, you know, one of the other people, you know, I mention in this particular chapter, you know, when we get into this, you just mentioned George King. George King, again, was a person who rose to prominence in Britain and ultimately moved to the United States to live, and who set up an organization that's still in existence to this day called the Aetherius Society, which essentially was born out of George King's experiences, again, with very angelic-looking, long-haired, human-like aliens, which actually began back in his childhood and that extended throughout his life. And today, the Aetherius Society has a large following of devotees and people that, you know, support its belief systems. And, you know, his time, if you like, in the UFO field goes back to the 1950s, and the group's still going strong, which again demonstrates, you know, the popularity and support that the contactees got and still get to this day.
Well, I have known people in various levels of society,
mm-hmm.
and of course in my work I encounter so many, but I can tell you there are a number, even people in the military,
mm-hmm.
that have had their own experiences and said,
yes.
this is what's happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something they don't have to say it to me to impress me. It's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
These are my own feelings. I've had mm-hmm. experiences of my own, of type. And so I just say, yes, that is not something that's out of reach in the
mm-hmm.
way of thinking if you really want to get down to earth. And there's conversations I had just in the last 2 weeks. I was telling people that you were going to be on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the phone with someone, and they said, oh, boy, I can tell you stories that I haven't had the experiences, but I have people that I know
mm-hmm.
that have had experiences. So you get this from so many different individuals, and why there is an elitist attitude that the mentality of the average
mm-hmm.
citizen is just going to go, oh, my goodness, this is terrible, and go freak out
mm-hmm.
is beyond me. I mean,
yes.
most people are not of that dispositioning at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that it's just fascinating that this sort of mental paranoia regarding this, and that's my description,
mm-hmm.
takes too much of a precedent.
Yeah, I actually agree with you, Donna. I think, you know, a lot of arguments, incorrect arguments have been made that, well, if the government told us the truth, that everybody would, you know, go running to mental hospitals or have nervous breakdowns, you know, I think there would be a lot of concern as to what the UFO intelligences want. But equally, I think today a lot of people now accept the idea that there is a genuine UFO phenomenon. I think government agencies don't give us the credit we deserve for being able to cope with something like this. You know, it's like at the height of the Cold War, everybody lived under the threat of nuclear war, but we
mm-hmm.
didn't stop society functioning at a normal level every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't fall into breakdowns and worrying endlessly, not being able to sleep. We just got on with our everyday lives and hoped it never happened. And I think with a UFO presence, that even if we didn't have all the answers, it wouldn't cause a major uproar in society. I think people would incorporate it into their lives and say something along the lines of, well, we thought this was going on anyway, and it would be a wait-and-see game as to
mm-hmm.
What the outcome would be. But I think the UFO subject is a benign one. You know, if these beings were here to destroy us, they could have done so long before we had space travel, atomic weapons, you know. And so why, if they're going to destroy us, why wait till we have a chance to fight back? That doesn't make sense. So I think they're essentially benign, but I think they have a policy of staying in the background and not interfering too much and upsetting our culture and society.
Well, and you cover this in your book to a small degree, there's many different legends and ancient cultures
mm-hmm.
that have talked about these visitors that have
yes.
been here going back thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fascinating. The Aborigines of Australia even have a record that they have in the inside of a cave.
Mm-hmm.
There's just all of this information,
mm-hmm.
and it's just so fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
That there is this attitude that this is all bunk, you know, we're the
yeah,
only planet in
exactly.
the universe. But it's okay. It's something that I think will always make for a good conversation. And those that have had experiences, they know their experiences,
mm-hmm.
and they're one-on-one. Now, you also have an excellent chapter, which we won't have a chance to go into, on manipulating the mind,
mm-hmm.
which I think is very well done. So for those that are listening, I want them to know that they can go to your website, nickredfern.com. That's NickredFern.com. Nick, this book, Contactees, A History of Alien-Human Interaction, I think is terrific. Because
well, thank you, Donna. Thank
you. You have been able to present enough of what I'd call the variety of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And also you make very honest comments about a couple of men here that have gotten a lot of notoriety that really were not up to par. They weren't up to snuff.
No,
and
but I think overall
mm-hmm.
it's a positive
overall.
Phenomenon. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of corroborating evidence And for all of the so-called hush-hush attitude, there are still a lot of people that are still doing research on it, and I'm so glad that people like you are coming forth and being vocal about it, because I think it's important. I think it really is.
Well, I appreciate that, Donna. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's been a delight. NickRedfern.com. Check out his website and his other publications, but Contact Ease really makes for good reading. If you say, I'm bored, I wonder what I should get to, get this out in your library. You will not be bored for very long. Nick, again, thank you for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. Don't forget to go to NickRedfern.com and find out more about Contact Ease. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, all I need from you when you call in is your first name or your initial. Then I also like to know where you're calling in from, of course. Then I'm happy to give you what I perceive, and you're welcome when I'm finished to ask me a question about anything that crosses your mind. I'll be delighted to answer it for you. So again, 888-815-9756. Also, I want to mention, and you'll hear me mention this probably for a good year, I am in the process of collecting 100 stories about paranormal experiences that people have had, whether it's out of body, whether it has to do with telepathy, whether it has to do with whatever your experience was. I'd love to hear your story. This book that I'm putting together, I want to be able to present different types of experiences so that maybe someone who has been going through their own experiences won't feel so alone, and they'll realize that the paranormal, the psychic, a lot of people go through these various happenings, and they need to know that they're not alone. So this is something that I'm really starting to have fun with. I'm getting some stories from different people. Again, I'm aiming for 100, and if you'd like to have your story considered, please send it to me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. Also, you could send it via snail mail to Donna, the Donna Sebo Show, and that's at P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. Now, remember, I must have your contact information, because if the publisher wants to use your story, then what we're going to do is need a release form, more than likely, when that occurs. So, again, be sure you send your contact information. Also, I want to let you know the Pacific Northwest Women's Show is coming up in Seattle, Washington. I've been involved with this show for years, and I just felt so pleased. Last year, we had done what they called a girl talk stage, and I had brought in a number of speakers, and they asked me if I would do it again this year. And I'm so delighted. I've got six powerful women speakers that between 1 and 4 o'clock on Friday, the 5th of March, I'm going to have it. Of course, the women's show is the 5th, 6th, and 7th. And hey, gals, you don't want to miss this. This is good stuff if you're in the state of Washington. It is an event that you are just going to love. So if you can, the speakers, I'll be having a list in my newsletter, and I will be announcing more of that. We're getting confirmation from the six women. We'll be talking about money, we'll be talking about healing therapy, and we'll also have an hour dedicated to animals. So this is really going to be an exciting afternoon, and be sure and tell your friends about it. The Northwest Women's Show, you can go online, find all out all about it, and get all of the details, where your tickets are, and you can go to certain places and get special tickets that will be discounted for you. There may be even information online about that, so go and check the Northwest Women's Show out. It is dynamic, and I will be in booth number 407, and of course I'll be doing many readings for people, but I'm going to have all kinds of books and good things to share with you, and some of Teresa Tapp stuff, and it's just really going to be a wonderful event. I just love it. It's showtime and so much fun. All dedicated to the gals. So it should be on your calendar March 5th, 6th, and 7th. Then I'm going to be in Alaska the first part of April, and there's another event that is going to be coming up, and I'm going to get information about that, and I'll let you know about it. But as much as I can, I'll also have in my newsletter. So that's going to be coming out on the 1st of February, so that's this upcoming weekend. So just know all of these good things are occurring. Again, give me a call today if you'd like to chat with me, 888-815-9756. That's a worldwide number, by the way. Beverly Palmer is a lady that had a particular experience of her own, and she happened to be with a group of people one day, and they were just having a good time. Talking. You know how you get a group of you together, get a bunch of friends together. And one of the people in the group, as part of the conversation, asked her a question. They said, Beverly, is there anything that you regret? The discussion had been about, gee whiz, if I could change anything, what would I change, so on and so forth. And that's why the question was posed. And when she reflected on it for a moment, she said, you know, it's really not a lot I'd change in my life, because I think there's a reason and a flow for the way things go on in life. However, something popped into her head, and she said, this is going to sound a little silly, but my grandparents were just the most special people to me. I was so close to them. And when I was young, I'd walk over to their house after school, and it was just a wonderful time to spend with them. And there was a chair that they had in their living room that I absolutely fell in love with. And it had striped upholstery, and you could tell the chair had been well used and was well loved, not just by me, but by other people. And I just loved the patterning that was in the wood, and I just felt like I was in a real safe place. And that was my chair, and my grandparents had just, that was my space, and we'd have cookies and hot cocoa. And when they passed away, they knew how much I loved the chair, so they willed the chair to me. And as I grew up and had a home of my own, it was one of my very special pieces of furniture in my home. Well, there came a time many, many years later Beverly said, where she found that they were going through some very, very difficult financial times. We've all had things like that occur to us. And she said, we wanted to buy a swing set for our young children, so we held a yard sale. And she knew that the one item that would definitely sell, she'd get good money for it, was the chair, the antique chair that her grandparents had given to her. She said, I really didn't want to do it, but I really knew that this was the one thing that was going to give us the cash we needed so we could buy what we wanted for the children. Well, as she knew, the chair was, you know, sold at a good price. They were able to buy the swing set. And she said, you know, we had to move out of town the following year because of circumstances. And when I moved out of that town, I felt like I had left a piece of me behind, part of my family legacy, because obviously it was in someone else's home. And she, when she was talking to her friends at this gathering, she said, you know what? That was over 22 years ago. And I know it sounds silly, but I often think about my grandparents' chair. Well, two of the women in her group just looked at each other, and they said, you know what? You need to see something. And so she went down at their urging into the church basement that she was having this meeting in, and she said, it was like walking into her grandparents' living room, and sitting in front of her when she went downstairs was her grandparents' chair. It had the same material on it. It was that nothing had been changed. Serendipitous? Coincidence? I don't know, but I love the story, and I had to share it with you. I think it is so much fun when you hear about things coming back to a person full circle when they think they have lost it forever. And I had a personal experience of that type with an item that I had given my mother when I was 17 years old. I had a job. With my very first check, I bought her a cut crystal salad bowl with a sterling silver edged trim. And my mother really liked pretty things. And I could afford this with my check, and I gifted her that. Well, after her death in 1991, I was going through her things, and there was this box. Actually, it was a number of boxes that hadn't been opened for years. We're talking like maybe 30 years. And I went into those boxes, and lo and behold, I found that salad bowl I had given my mother when I was 17. She had packed it away, and it was just as good as new. It was absolutely amazing, and so that was put to use right away. It's amazing sometimes how items will come to those that really know how to take care of them. And it's fun stories like this. I just think life is so interesting, don't you? You never know when something is going to come your way that's going to show you that there's more to life than meets the eye. I know that's a fact. And I know being in the psychic area, it makes you more attuned and attentive. But there is a rhyme and a reason in life. For all the discord that we see, there is more that goes on than you can ever imagine. So if you can give yourself a gift, give yourself the gift of expectation of the highest and the best. And know that if you want to have certain things manifest in your life, just expect that they're going to be able to be there. Whether it's beauty, whether it's money, whether it's a relationship, have the faith and the trust to know that you can have an experience and have what it is that is really very meaningful and special to you in your life. It will come into your space, sometimes in ways that you would never, ever have dreamed. In a million years, you couldn't have programmed it. It really is amazing how life works out. It's a true adventure, but trusting, having faith, and releasing, not trying to own things, Boy, I know I still work on that. I really do. So if you feel sometimes frustrated with yourself, join the Club of Humanity. We all do. Nobody goes through this life going la, 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 and tiptoeing through yellow tulips all the time. It doesn't work that way. We're all going to get skin knees and lumpy bumps as we move along. But believe me, there's a lot of good stuff, a lot of sunshine, a lot of blessings if you're merely open to them and allow them to come in their own way. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. I have something here. You know, we were talking about UFOs earlier and various points of information, and the topic is always a fascinating one because there's so many modalities with these experiences that people have. Well, there is a Rendlesham Forest incident, and it took place in 1980. Remember, my guest Nick, his father was involved with the military and was a radar specialist, knew how to read all kinds of things. Well, this happened on December 27th. There was a U.S. Army officer, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, and he had to leave rather quickly, an awards dinner at the Royal Air Force Base in Woodbridge, Suffolk, England, to investigate a UFO report in Rendlesham Forest. Now, it was the second report that had been made in 3 days. So Holt ordered lights set up all around the area of concern, and once they were in place, the lights wouldn't work. They were all working, set them up, then they don't work. The communication radios would not work. Well, the lieutenant colonel, Holt and his team continued into the woods and were examining the previous landing spot that had been discussed when they became aware that there were animals, farm animals, that were nearby that were extremely agitated. And then in front of them, a glowing object came into their view, and it was zigzagging through all of the trees. And it settled in a field, and around it was a very thick circular fog, and there was a thrumming sound. That's how it was described, a thrumming sound. And there was yellow and red tones that just illuminated the object. And then it suddenly began to throw off sparks, and they thought it actually was melting in front of them. And then all of a sudden, it silently, no noise with this, silently exploded into five separate white objects that flew away, Each of these objects displayed red, green, and blue lights. Now, one of these saucers, that's how they described them, beamed down a laser-thin ray of light, they said, and it seemed to be under somebody's control. They used the term intelligent control. And it began doing a grid search through Rendlesham. And then another one of the flying objects zipped past one of the broken lights, and that light went on. When it went past it, it went on. Now, 2 days before this experience, John Burroughs and James Pennington were investigating a UFO report in Rendlesham, noticed that the air was filled, just loaded with static electricity. And they spotted a triangular metallic object that had a pulsing red light on its top, and it was banked by blue lights below, and the whole forest was just aglow. And when they approached, these two men, when they approached this object, they said there was a sense of slowness, like time itself was an effort, and they had a real difficult time trying to walk. They were able to get close enough to the object where they saw symbols on its exterior. They even got close enough where they could touch this object, and when they did, it became extremely bright and flew away. But no sound in the flight. No sound at all. Wouldn't we love that at the airport? They found, after this experience, there were three depressions in frozen ground. Three depressions in frozen ground where they had landed. Fascinating stories. All of this documented. So, do you think all mysteries are solved? Not hardly. We've got a lot of things we know absolutely nothing about. And that's what makes life really an interesting experience. I came across a study that I thought was sort of light and fun. Reality shows. Now, I'm not really into reality shows very much because I think so many of them, and this is my bias, are made up. I think they're just scripted and people do all of these unusual things. But that's my total bias. But I came across this study, and there was a psychologist, Chris Logan, of a particular university. He said, you know, it's really fascinating. People have their preferences, and he had some things that he itemized out. So I just thought I'd share this with you because it's whimsical and wacky. If you absolutely love any of the reality shows that are about food and kitchen and that type of thing, then they say you're a curious rationalist. They say these shows put the spotlight on everyday act and show it to be surprisingly dramatic. It's detail-oriented and organized. If you like watching what goes into the dish while witnessing all of the behind-the-stove-top stress, that really is something that you just thoroughly enjoy. You are the type of person that's always in search of new ideas and recipes, and you just get excited about the little things in life. Now, what if you like the fashion stuff? They say you're a refined pragmatist with these reality shows. Your attraction to programs about beauty and fashion hints at your two sides, the practical and the posh. After all, these shows are as much about the stress of deadlines as they are about glamour, and you're as rational as when it comes to getting things done as you are refined when it comes to polishing your outfits. Now, if you love the wedding shows, if you like things like that, you're an innovative artisto. Yes. Creative, that's what you are. You thrive on challenges, you love wedding planning constraints, you like dealing with budgets, deadlines, because they force you to artistically be very, very creative and think outside the box. So you're organized, you like to imagine, you're the person that's in charge getting everything in place and in detail. Now, do you like the performance-packed reality shows, like America's Got Talent, American Idol, Dancing with the Stars? You're an emotional dreamer. People are rarely as vulnerable as when they're performing before judges, and that's what attracts you. These shows require a big investment from the viewer because they're fraught with emotion. A dreamer yourself, you will identify with contestants, and while you feel for all of them, you also relish seeing stars rise to the top. And last but not least, the political and dramatic shows. You are a shrewd thinker. Shows like The Bachelor, The Real Housewives series, Survivor, Well, politics in action. That's right. That you want to choose the right words to woo by. You want to know how to do things the right way. You're smart, you're complex, and you prefer the drama of watching real feelings unfold to the pat endings of fiction. Wild and wacky. This is Donna Siebel. I know we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't ever forget, you are the person that creates the unique and unusual. Trust, have faith, and release to your highest good. You're going to find wonderful things are going to come your way. Donna Siebel here. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about workplace evolution. Gail Gregory, looking for a job, want to know how to adapt to the new environment? We'll find out more tomorrow. Donna Siebel here. Have a fabulous, fabulous day, a wonderful evening. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.